So, this morning I'm going to read from my book that just came out a couple weeks ago, Zen in the Age of Anxiety, Wisdom for Navigating Our Modern Lives. I read, it came out the end of the first week in June, and I had a reading at Majors and Quinn. So this is my second reading, and I'm going to read some of the same things and some different ones. So first of all, I would like to thank Wanda Isle for taking a bunch of my talks that I gave over the years and putting them together so they seemed intelligible. So there seemed to be a beginning, a middle, and an end. And thank you. Thank you. Secondly, before I get into it, this was not our idea to call this Zen in the Age of Anxiety. This was a little byline that Wanda had, and we were going to call it Hearts Undivided. But Shambhala said, they read it and they said, no, this is Zen in the Age of Anxiety. So here we are, we're in the Age of Anxiety, and we're doing Zen. And I think it seems to be attracting a lot of attention because of that. But now people are thinking it's going to be a primer on to help them with anxiety. And one of the reviewers said, well, he didn't say anything at all except we should just sit. So he gave it 1 star out of 5. So there you go. But it's certainly attracting attention. What?
Wear that star, probably.
Yeah, right. So I'm going to dip into it and read different sections. And this is my talks over the years, so some of you have heard all this at least once. But I'm going to start with, in this age of anxiety, so many people fall into a kind of a trance of unhappiness, a trance of disquiet with what's happening politically, what's happening economically, what's happening socially, and it gets to us. So we fall into a trance of unhappiness. So in my first section, I talk about the surfing metaphor, meditation as helping us see through the trance of anxiety. The ocean is a good metaphor for our interconnected life. With a regular meditation practice, we can learn to surf life's waves, but chances are good that we will sometimes be overpowered by them for a while. A technique like following your breath is a great surfboard for riding these waves. But when the surf is up and you're being submerged in wave after wave of fear, anger, and anxiety, you may need a more specialized surfboard. Possibly adding counting your breath, repeating a mantra or phrase that is meaningful to you, or doing walking meditation rather than simply sitting still. Sometimes Jerry was this guy that taught me how to surf, my next-door neighbor. He was 6'4", and I was 5'6", and he used a big wooden board. I mean, this is the late 1950s, you know, nothing. It was a big, heavy wooden board, and I just used my body because I couldn't even pick up one of those big boards. Sometimes Jerry and I felt as if we were wasting our time trying to surf. We were just getting knocked over by one wave after another. Days and sometimes even weeks went by when we weren't making any progress at all. Very discouraging. Life can be like that. But with a regular meditation practice, you learn to experience each wave, not as an obstacle to your real life, but as your real life. Eventually, you may learn to enjoy the surf directly with no board at all. Experiencing the joy of being fully immersed in the water, regardless of its turbulent energies. Each wave has its own unique nature. It also has the nature of the entire ocean, because a wave is not separate from the ocean. You learn to be patient when you're riding the energy of the entire ocean. Jerry and I surfed on calm days and on stormy days. Surfing on stormy days isn't easy, but the storm is never separate from the calmness down below. Even so, for every thrilling swell that lifts you upward toward the sky, there's a trough that can send you reeling into the darkest depths. Troughs are part of the ocean, too. When you're in a deep trough, you can't go forward and you can't retreat. Nor can you predict what will come next, because you can't see beyond the trough. In the troughs, you learn to trust, to have courage, and to be patient, qualities that come naturally if you're committed to surfing the entire ocean. Wave by wave is how we stay engaged with life. It's the only way to experience the immediacy and vigor that real life offers. Sure, it's raw, but we don't need to protect ourselves from the moods and nuances of life's great ocean. We can stay right with it in placid times and in turbulent times. Life is always offering us the energy and vitality we need. Just let the salt water seep into your pores. You can learn to surf the chaos and uncertainty that real life... Oh, can you learn? This is my question to you. Can you learn to surf the chaos and uncertainty that real life includes without falling into a trance of unworthiness? You can. A surfer is powerless to change the towering wave rushing toward her, but she doesn't want to change it. She wants to surf it, and she learns to feel safe in the immense ocean of being, even when she falls. She confidently gets right back up to meet the next wave. So sometimes through our sitting, especially in our retreat sitting, those of you who have done retreat sitting, and if you haven't, I encourage you to do it, we can experience a wonderful stillness of the ocean's depth and breath. And sometimes when we do this, it's wonderful, and sometimes it can be a little freaky. So this is what I'm talking about in the next excerpt. A few years ago, during a long retreat, a student came to see me for a private meeting. She said, "I think it's going well because my mind has gotten very quiet. But it's kind of scary. Who will I be if I lose myself? How will I function in the world?" As she spoke, she churned up more and more doubt until finally she exclaimed, "I think I should go home now." Anybody ever experienced that in retreat? "I think I should go home now." In Zen retreats, when you finally experience some stillness, these questions become relevant. How do you identify with non-being? There's nothing there to identify with. It can be disconcerting at first, but it's right here, in the thick of the forest, that we discover a wonderful freedom that our moving mind cannot reach. I encourage the retreat participant to stay with her anxiety and ride it out. She agreed to give it a try. When she came to see me a couple of days later, her mood was different. She spoke of the stillness and peacefulness she was experiencing. When the bell rang to end a meditation session, she says, "My body rose on its own." She said, "My body knows what to do." Can you believe it? Your body knows what to do? Your body is pretty trustworthy if you just allow it to be as it is. Just follow it as it is. Whatever you experience in meditation becomes your teacher if you just stay with it. Even asthma can be your teacher, as my friend Eleanor discovered. Eleanor was planning a long retreat with Katagiri Roshi, then the guiding teacher here. She was worried about doing the retreat because she had to use an inhaler frequently. That meant that she would have to use it during meditation, but she was clinging to her idea that she should not move during meditation. Katagiri Roshi encouraged her to do the retreat. He counseled her to be with the stress in her throat, if she could, and use her inhaler whenever she needed to. "Use the stress in your throat as your object of meditation," he said. Eleanor began the retreat knowing that she could use her inhaler at any time. But as the retreat went on, she was able to relax into the stress in her throat more and more. She stayed for the entire 7-day retreat. By the end, she noticed that her throat muscles had relaxed and her breath was not so shallow. By being with it, rather than trying to avoid it or escape it, asthma became Eleanor's place of freedom with no limitation. No limitation. So then I'm continuing in the book. I have three chapters on what are three primary causes of anxiety in our culture. Sex, money, and failure. I'm not going to read sex and money today. I didn't even know I'd given talks on them, but Wanda said, oh, yeah, you gave one on sex. And I said, I gave a talk on sex? And I know I gave a bunch on money. I'm not reading that today. But as we know, I used to be a therapist, and couples, two main issues for couples in enduring relationships, tend to be sex and money. Two main issues, at least until a certain age. I don't exactly know what that age is, but some age. Then it's only money. So I'm going to read about failure. Unfortunately, our culture takes a dim view of failure. Americans live in a very competitive culture, so much so that life often feels like a contest filled with big winners and big losers. And certainly our leaders are role modeling that. In business, sports, and the arts, we tend to worship winners and marginalize those who fail. So how do we cope with failure? Perhaps we need a cultural shift in the way we think about failure. When I was a kid, I had to do an hour of work a week. Poor me. Poor me. I thought it was a lot, but then I saw what my friends had to do. In the summer, my job was pulling dandelions from the lawn. And it seemed to me that every week there were twice as many dandelions as the week before. Surprisingly, dandelions fail to germinate five times more often than they succeed. This is an extraordinary failure rate. However, based on diversity and perseverance, they also have an extraordinary success rate. Botanists have identified about 100 different types of dandelion. You'll find them sprouting up from fallow dirt or rich soil, and they thrive at both sea level and high altitudes. Consequently, the humble dandelion has been around for 30 million years. So that's the deal with dandelions. What about human beings? Ernest Hemingway wrote the ending to his novel A Farewell to Arms 47 times. That means 46 consecutive failures, but he persevered. When you read Hemingway, he just seems so natural, you know, just so, words are so simple, but 47 times before he really got it come out in that natural, simple way. Thomas Edison failed with 1,000 different filaments before he found the one that enabled him to create the first successful incandescent light bulb. We humans have an extraordinary failure rate, but we also have an extraordinary success rate. When Michael Jordan tried out for his high school basketball team, he didn't make it. Then he started practicing every day. He got a lot of help and support from his grandmother. I didn't put that in the book. When he tried out in college, he still didn't make the A team, but he kept practicing. Michael Jordan finally became Michael Jordan after he failed, adapted, and persevered. And here's what he says. Whenever I was working out and got tired and figured I ought to stop, I'd close my eyes and see that list in the locker room without my name on it. That usually got me going again. So maybe failure is a prerequisite for success. Maybe dandelions survived because of their extraordinary failure rate rather than in spite of it. They were forced to adapt, to venture into new territory, and to diversify. Likewise, perhaps the most successful people are those who fail the most. You could say that persistence in failure is what success is all about. The research of Jonathan Hay, a psychologist at the University of Virginia, suggests that happiness may require adversity, setbacks, and even trauma. If you don't get the kind of information failure provides, Hayes says, you will end up with unrealistic expectations. So, through our Zen practice, sitting facing the one, we have lots of opportunities to fail, don't we? But if we allow ourselves to fail and try again and fail and try again, we become humble. My next chapter, become humble. Not religious humility where you're trying to be humble so that people will think you're good. Or they'll see you think you're good yourself, right? You'll just become naturally humble. Okay, reading from the chapter on humility now. Humility comes from the Latin word humus, meaning earth or ground. In English, humus means soil. Human beings came from the salt water of the oceans and from the richness of the soil. The philosopher and author Alan Watts used to say that the earth is peopling, producing human beings the way an apple tree apples by producing fruit. The humus is aerated and moist because it's not separate from the air and rain. It supports us, but not in the way we're accustomed to think. It consists of fire, air, water, and all manner of decomposing beings. When you sink all the way into the humus, beautiful wildflowers can bloom right where you are. Beautiful wildflowers right where you are. But there's no security in being a wildflower. It feels much safer to be a polished stone, to look good to others and stand out in the world. But very little grows on a polished stone. Besides, if you think about it, you may realize that you've been stony for too many years already. Try something different. Sink down into the earth. All the nourishment you need is here. With natural humility, you go all the way down into the humus, rather than sticking up like you're some big deal, because you've got something that others don't have. When you sink all the way to the ground, you actually are a big deal. Not because you are you, but because you're not you. You've touched the ground of all being, which is not a solid ground at all. It's completely aerated with all life. Instead of trying to be somebody special, inhabiting a natural humility allows you to be something much more. It allows you the freedom to be nobody in particular. Nada de particular. I left out the Spanish in the book. Nobody to defend or uphold. Nobody to judge or good or bad. And no one in need of redemption. So then in that chapter I have examples. Is this working okay, Jim? I'm looking at the guy who sent me up on two of these. So my examples in the book are about humility are from Suzuki, and I tell these stories over and over again, so humor me and just listen. Or you can space out while I'm talking and then look like you're listening. But please, look like you're listening. It's required. It's a mandate. So, this story. Humility. Okay, so... I could read it, it'd be real quick, but I'm going to tell it. It'll take a little longer. So once I have a friend named, I think this is in the first book maybe, or I don't know, maybe it's in the second book. I have a friend named Betty, who's a concert pianist, and this is many years ago, more than 50 years ago. She has really severe depression, and she's fallen into a trough. Talk about falling into a trough. Such a trough that she can't even do zazen in the morning. I mean, I know we get up at a very unusual hour, but she used to get up at that hour. Now she's in a trough. She can't do it. But she's still able to play the piano, and she plays tennis. Those are the two things she's able to do. So I run into my teacher once in the morning, I don't know, after breakfast or something, and he's got, I've only seen him in black generally, but he's got white tennis shorts on, and he has a bald head. So he's going out in the sun, so he's got a sailor cap on. And Kategori used to wear one of these too, Kategori Roshi, a sailor cap to protect him from the sun. So there he is. He's 4'11". He's got these white tennis shorts and this sailor hat pulled down. And I say, Sensei, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm going to play tennis. And I said, you're going to play tennis? With who? with Betty. And I said, with Betty? Oh, yeah, Betty plays tennis. But I said, but you don't know how to play tennis. And he said, no, but Betty does. So I said, well, can I come? Well, he said, sure. So then I go to the court, and Betty is a little taller than Suzuki. She's maybe 5'1", but she's a good tennis player. And they only play for about a half an hour. And he mostly misses the ball. He mostly misses the ball. And he mostly misses the ball, and lots of times he falls down. And then when he gets up, he guffaws, like he's played a joke on Betty and me. And that's the whole deal. That's the whole deal. But, you know, to fall down and then to laugh about it and to get up. Humility, huh? Humility. Not fake religious humility. Just humility that comes from sinking into this aerated humus, which includes all life. So if we practice with failure and humility, then we naturally move into what modern psychologists call flow, but also what ancient Taoists call flow. The psychologists think they discover this flow thing, you know, but actually they're 2,500 years too late. But you're never too late. They're never too late. Anyway, they've researched it, right? So I talk about the research in here. Our evolutionary coping mechanism, the fear response, fight, flight, freeze, has outlived its usefulness for most situations that we face. It has become the problem rather than the solution. It evolved to protect the body, but our body is rarely in danger in this modern world. Now the fear response is mostly about protecting our self-image. We have another mechanism that may be even more deeply rooted than the fight, flight, or freeze response. It allows us to thrive in a complex world. Most commonly, it is called the flow state. If you're a runner, you may know it as runner's high. If you're into team sports, you may call it being in the zone. If you're a jazz musician, it's in the pocket. If you're an activist or caretaker, you may have experienced helper's high. If you're a Taoist, you may call it riding the clouds and following the wind. Like fight, flight, freeze, a flow state arises unbidden. We can't command it, but we can create the conditions for it. In sports, Michael Jordan is a great example of someone who knew how to promote a flow state. There was a certain quality of mind that Jordan brought to the basketball court. He concentrated on the ball and his moves, not the crowd or even his opponents. He was immersed in the intrinsic pleasure of the game itself. I call the kind of deep concentration Jordan brought to the court bare awareness. Others call it mindfulness. With bare awareness, you don't get stuck on a goal. You're not trying to achieve something through your concentration. When Jordan went into a flow state, he seemed to control the whole court. Even those watching in the stands and from their living rooms participated in his flow state. In these moments, we are able to respond, to suspend our judgments and concerns and become a participant in the wonderful synchronous activity unfolding in the court. Who is really the center if everyone together is in flow? It's a multi-centered flow. So here's what Chuangzi says 2,500 years before. Flow with whatever is happening and let your mind be free. Stay centered by accepting whatever you are doing. This is the ultimate. This is the ultimate. So in the talk that I gave, I think 2 weeks ago, I talked about learning how to swim in a really small swimming pool that had walls. It had 3 feet deep, 4 feet deep, 5 feet deep, only to 6 feet, and it was only 30 feet long. It was a nice small pool. And that was my teacher, and I learned to kind of flow. It took me a while. First I had an inner tube, and I learned to flow in that little pool. And then little by little, my friend Jerry taught me how to do the same thing in the ocean. But the ocean doesn't have a perimeter. The ocean is scary. But little by little, we learn to immerse ourselves in this big ocean. And we can go deep below. When a big wave comes, we can go deep below. So the waves don't get us. Well, sometimes they get us. That's okay. That's part of life. But then we can go deep, and it's all the same flow. But it takes practice. It takes practice. Boredom practice, fatigue practice, enlightenment practice, stupidity practice, anxious practice, practice. So, this brings me to the research on neuroplasticity, which I'm only going to dip into. I'm doing less on brain science than at Majors and Quinn. There's quite a bit of brain science in here. But not as much as in Guy and Laney's book. If you want to read a book that's got good brain science, read the book that just came out by Guy and Laney. Guy Gibbon. Okay. Norman Doidge, the psychiatrist. Even though the brain is fluid and plastic, through brain noise, habit, and addiction, the soft Play-Doh texture of the brain hardens. We know now that the brain is completely open and without fixed boundaries. Just within the last 10 years have we realized that. Prior to that, the brain was thought of as made up of different compartments that pretty much stayed within themselves. Even so, our incessant mental chatter, habituated thought patterns, and other addictive behaviors create an unnatural rigidity within the Play-Doh texture of the brain. It's not age, but repetitive thoughts and behaviors that inhibit our brain's ability to grow new neural pathways through our lifetime. Plasticity gives rise to flexibility. Yet paradoxically, plasticity can also lead to rigidity. If new behaviors become locked in through repetition, the brain's natural reward system can become a hindrance to the brain's natural plasticity. The organic chemical dopamine, which is part of the neural reward system, is a primary cause of the brain's deterioration over time. Dopamine acts as a mediator between neurons. When it's released by the brain and kidneys, where it is synthesized, we experience a surge of pleasure and confidence, strong motivation to repeat whatever we did to initiate the release. When dopamine is released in excess, it becomes an intoxicant, locking us into addictive behaviors and hindering the brain's natural ability to respond in fresh ways. Our primary addiction is to the chattering mind, which sustains and reinforces the belief in a separate self. But mental chatter doesn't activate a dopamine release. Because we're in pain from that addiction, we turn to secondary addictions for the dopamine. In the 21st century, our two biggest secondary addictions are computer-related, computer porn and electronic games. We see these addictions all the time in adults and in children. Many neurologists now recommend two activities to maintain brain plasticity. Novelty, and what might the second be? Meditation. Novelty means learning new skills like dancing, riding a bike, or a new language, anything that you haven't done before. My son-in-law, Eric, is from France. When he and my daughter, Erin, got married, they had a big wedding in France. At the reception, my wife, Linda, and I were expected to dance the first dance, along with Erin and Eric and Eric's parents. This was a very formal wedding, and the first dance was to be a waltz. I hadn't danced in years, and even when I did dance, it wasn't ballroom dancing. And when I took dancing lessons, I always had to dance with a teacher because I was so klutzy. So Linda and I took lessons. Once a week for several weeks, and between lessons, we practiced at home. Of course, Linda caught on right away. I'm glad she's not doing Zen practice anymore. She caught on to everything right away. She always seemed to learn new things easily. I was a klutz. My dancing was awful, but I didn't want to let my daughter down or embarrass myself in front of hundreds of people, so I stayed with it. Life is always offering opportunities for us to create new neural pathways. All we have to do is say yes more often. But learning new skills involves frustration. Learning to waltz involved a lot of frustration. Here is where the second recommendation by neuroscientists come in, meditation. When we meditate, frustration and discouragement are common companions. We learn to recognize them as they are arising. We get to know them intimately, so we're not blindsided and overwhelmed by them. They become like distant cousins whom we don't particularly enjoy, but whom we treat kindly when they visit. Monkey mind is the leading cause of symptoms related to aging, like the diminished ability to find words, diminished short-term memory, and the inability to sustain a focused attention. But we now know that it's not age, but the atrophy of our attentional system that is responsible for many of these symptoms. The capacity to focus and sustain our attention is like any other ability. If we don't use it, we lose it. As our capacity to focus deteriorates, we rely more and more on habituated behaviors, a reliance that increases brain rigidity and decreases plasticity. Do you see the vicious cycle that we get trapped in? Meditative awareness allows us to see our patterns as they are forming before they become deeply ingrained. The key to freeing ourselves from habituated behaviors is seeing in the moment what is actually driving us, so we can intervene with a mid-course correction. And now I want to just read a little bit from the last chapter and then see if there are any Q&A. Oh, and a Q, I guess I do the A, but you guys could do the A and I could do the Q. Or we could Q&A together. Whatever. Let's see. The last chapter. This last chapter is deep. But what's not deep? It's shallow. Living and dying in a state of readiness. As Zen Koan says, medicine and sickness heal each other. All the world is medicine. Seeing medicine and sickness as opposite sides of the same coin is a non-dualistic approach to healing. The fact that medicine can both heal and kill is the basis for homeopathic medicine and for vaccines. A vaccine introduces our immune system to a small amount of a specific type of disease so it can learn how to deal with it. Meditation works the same way. We experience agitation when we sit still and try to focus on our breath, constantly having to bring our awareness back again and again. Moment by moment, we bring our gentle awareness to the bodily sensations associated with agitation. We don't try to avoid or deny the unpleasant sensations and emotions that arise. Over time, we learn to deal with agitation caused by distraction and agitation caused by mental noise. Then, when a big agitation or a strong emotion comes along, our body knows how to deal with it without becoming overwhelmed. We have been immunized through familiarity. Meditative awareness allows us to see deeply into the circumstances of our life. We learn something about ourselves. As we become more and more familiar with our responses, we learn to recognize those that empower us and those that imprison us, trapping us in repetitive patterns. We learn how to experience frustration, agitation, and emotional disturbance without being controlled or overcome by them. Empowerment is not about freedom from the chaotic energies of everyday life. It is freedom within those energies. Medicine may also induce sickness. When I was young, I was allergic to poison oak. I used a homeopathic remedy, which means on a regular basis, I took a small amount of the poison oak that I was allergic to. But once I was distracted and took too much, my entire body swelled up. Even experiences where the sense of a separate self drops away can be the source of illness. On the one hand, we feel a deep and joyful interconnectedness with all life. On the other hand, letting go of your separate identity can be extremely disorienting. These experiences are a natural outcome of meditation, but they may also arise suddenly through our circumstances, like illness, trauma, or drug use. To cling to life and avoid death is fundamentally unnatural. Of course, we'll feel sad or grieve when we lose a loved one, or when we find our own health and youth fading. But if we can let this sadness enter our hearts completely, we have an opportunity to develop a deep acceptance of the natural ebb and flow of life. Denying the way of things keeps us on the wheel of reacting, regretting, and rehearsing. The wheel spins so fast we don't have time to love or grieve. On the deepest level, medicine and sickness heal each other means that life and death heal each other. It points directly to the non-dual relationship between life and death. It says that life is death and death is life. A breath includes an inhale and an exhale. One provides the means for the other. In meditation, an appreciation of this reality begins to permeate our being, to penetrate down to our bones and marrow, inoculating us against our greatest fears. This is the last thing I'm going to read, last paragraph. The courageous person knows that living fully requires the willingness to die to each moment, giving oneself completely to every exhale and then allowing the inhale to happen on its own. Each moment becomes like a torch burning at both ends, releasing tremendous energy. Tremendous energy. You may get exhausted by this practice for a while, but if you keep with it, you'll discover that you have infinite energy. Then, when the last inhale comes, it's not such a big deal because we know how to exhale completely. We know how to meet death because we've learned how to meet life. There is no attachment to the barrier we create between life and death, no walls to uphold, and nothing to defend or to oppose. So I feel lucky that I'm in this deteriorating body, which is may or may not be ready to die, but in a way, it dies continually by my just letting go, and then new cells are reborn. I feel lucky that I'm here at Zen Center helping folks learn to swim in a little indoor pool. Just sit on your zafu, just sit on your cushion and face the wall. 28 minutes, that's fine. 18 minutes, that's fine. Learn how to swim in the little indoor pool, and then, little by little, you'll be able to move into the embrace of the great ocean, the big ocean, beyond life-death division, me-you division, pool-ocean division, air-water division. And that's where you'll find safety and repose. That's natural. That's your natural state of mind. So that's what I want to say.